Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, David Shields is our guest. His new book is How Literature Saved My Life. One of his enterprises seems to me to be to provoke me. He's someone who feels that the novel is not just on hiatus, it's transformed. There may be certainly writers, but they're not the exciting ones writing novels just now. But my question is, why did your life need saving, or how literature saved my life from what?
I would say from dead language that, as you know, Michael, I wrote a novel quite a while ago called Dead Languages that deals with my stutter, that as a kid I had a horrible stutter and still have the remnants of a stutter now. And I feel that, you know, people think, oh, well, that's interesting, you have a slight stutter, but really, the definition of being human is that you can use language. It's virtually the thing that distinguishes us from apes, is that we have verbal language. And so when you have a profound stutter, you really are, in many ways, not fully human. And so I feel like a major project of my whole life has been to transform, you might say, dead language into, I hope, beautiful language of writing and reading. And so I would say, in general, stuttering to writing is one of the main ways the literature has saved my life.
Well, that's interesting. What did you do on the actual level to handle the stutter? Because, you know, I'd never know now.
Right.
It's always said about you, but I've never even heard it.
Well, thank you. That's nice to hear. It's been a lifelong project, both actually writing, but also speech therapy, and I do all sorts of elaborate things to control my stutter. Part of it, frankly, is just simply getting out and about. I read, I teach, I talk, you know, and so part of it is building up a muscle, but a lot of it was a huge amount of speech therapy, including with someone here in Los Angeles, Vivian Sheehan, who helped me a lot. There is something specifically I do called voluntary stuttering, in which it's very complicated, but it's actually kind of Buddhistically fascinating, that you actually intentionally stutter on words that you wouldn't ordinarily stutter on, and that builds up a muscle memory to be able to control those words that you might have problems with. I'm not sure what the analogy is in another phase of life, but it builds up a lot of emotional and physical nerve.
You mentioned that you went, when you were in school at Iowa, that you were simultaneously in the writing program and undergoing intensive speech therapy. So the communicating becomes that dual metaphor you're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, that was just this irony of ironies, this paradox of paradox for me, that I was 24, a graduate student in Iowa City, and everyone said, nothing ever happens to anyone in Iowa City, but I found my life on fire. I'd crossed this bridge back and forth. I always call them two houses of language. One house in which I was trying to use language exceptionally well, the other house in which I was a remedial speaker. And really, in both cases, I was trying to break language down. I was trying to become a better writer and stop writing like Thomas Hardy. And then in the speech clinic, I was trying to change all of my previous patterns in which I was endlessly substitute a different word for the word I was having trouble saying. This was a five-year project to get out of my system that pattern in which I would always, as if I couldn't say umbrella, I'd say bumbershoot, you know, and I'd sound like some walking thesaurus.
Uh-huh.
And I had to break that pattern.
Is it tiring to be controlling the stutter and substituting one word for another? Do you feel
sure.
exhausted by the end
of
the day?
Well, that's something I no longer do. I'm proud to say that that was something I did through adolescence and through early adulthood. But a lot of the things, the ways I changed my behavior ages sort of, I don't know, 20 to 30, is that I stopped doing that and started using the actual words, which in a way is not a bad segue to getting us to things like reality hunger or how literature saved my life, because it's almost as if after that, Michael, I started to get interested in what felt like the incorrigibly real. You know, that after I got interested in not substituting words, I got very loyal to as thin a membrane as possible between life and art.
You've written only one novel in which the heroes are outsiders. It's in fact called Heroes. From the second, Dead Languages, you're talking about the stutter. You begin to emerge, and then a whole series of books in which the interrogation of David Shields is the subject of the book. It seemed to me at a point, it's not that you're against the novel, more that you're against the invention of characters.
Well, that's I love that phrase of outsiders, that in this one book, Heroes, I made up people who were pretty far from my own life. And that in, as you say, the next 13 books, I think, to a greater or lesser extent, not entirely, in books like Black Planet or The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead, or even in some of the anthologies I've co-edited, you know, I'm not the principal subject. But your point is well taken, that in a way. But I think there was a recent piece I saw in Grantland by Alex Papademos about various current performance artists like Dan Harmon and various people. And Alex used the phrase self-deconstructive nonfiction. And he actually alluded glancingly to me and my work. And I just thought that was a very useful phrase. It really helped me understand what it is I'm doing. To answer your question, Michael, about the novel, you know, I just sort of do these occasional drive-by shootings of the novel. I'm not particularly interested in the novel, or I'm not particularly interested in arguing against the novel, and to the degree I'm known as some kind of anti-novel pamphleteer, that really bores me. It's a very, very minor part of my work, and somehow, sort of journalistically, it becomes a talking point because it's a sort of sexy tabloid topic. But in reality, I'm really interested in this thing David Foster Wallace said many years ago. Wallace was asked, what's so great about writing? And he said, well, we're existentially alone on the planet. You can't know what I'm thinking and feeling, and I can't know what you're thinking and feeling. And writing at its best is a bridge constructed across the abyss of human loneliness, which is, to me, a beautiful answer. Then Wallace went on to say, oh, by the way, in fiction, there's all these contrivances. There's plot and setting and character and invention. And he said, not too persuasively, he said, don't worry, we can get past those contrivances. A lot of what I'm doing is I'm trying to shoot the gap right there. I'm saying, no, I can't. I have trouble getting past those contrivances. As a writer and reader and teacher, I find those contrivances take me farther away often from the writer's real concerns.
I'm talking to David Shields about his book, How Literature Saved My Life. But for me, the problem didn't seem to be loneliness. The problem seemed to be life itself. And I wanted literature as an alternative to life, so that the more far-fetched, the more invented, the less autobiographical. This is when I was young and out of control of my feelings, lost in a lack of appetite for the things that my parents, my family, the people around me were talking about and telling me. I needed to escape to elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if that escape was in beautiful language, that helped a lot, because the writing, even if truthful, true to the facts, the writing would ensorcel me, would make me entranced. But for me, it was the Narnia books, the Oz books. What does Baudelaire say? Anywhere else than here.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me
this was in your 20s, say?
Oh, 14.
14, I see, yeah. Pretty young. Okay.
The fear of life, the parents, family members who would begin conversations with, what's the matter, cat got your tongue? Not that I couldn't speak, not stuttering, mm-hmm. but not wanting to,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not wanting to share it with them.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the sharing was with the pages of a book.
Right.
That was where I was me being spoken to by a peer, a mentor, a dream superior, a god. That was what made me mm-hmm. bookish.
Now, don't you think you have, I mean, it's not as if I'm here to say, Michael, or to anyone, that somehow that your experience is not, quote, the right one. That's absurd. But I think, don't you feel that you have moved on from that? I mean, do you still feel ensorcelled by a dreamscape? I guess I have a bit of an argument that I make, I think, in the last couple books, in which I try to say, you know, it's this Kafka line, you know, a book should be an axe to break the frozen sea within us. And I feel that so many books that, to me, you know, that we live in this landscape that's completely mediated, that's completely saturated, that's completely simulated. And I find that more dreamscape feels like more bubble wrap. In a lot of supposedly good novels, I'm bored out of my mind. The game is not worth the candle. The writer thinks he or she is exploring some larger topic, but in my experience, is actually there to entertain and seduce the reader, and is not truly, in my experience, investigating something substantial about human life. And the books I love, the books I try to write, the books I love reading, people like Simon Gray, Leonard Michaels, J.M. Coetzee, David Markson, Maggie Nelson, Sarah Manguso, Amy Fusselman, they are actually overtly, paragraph by paragraph, manifestly wrestling with a conundrum of human existence. They aren't telling me a lullaby story, a good night story. They're not trying to take me away from life. They're trying to take me deeper into life. And that I find a really exciting project.
I understand. And to some extent, of course, I agree. I think that really the self is the place where problems are insoluble, as is the world. No solution to the ongoing crisis in the Middle East. It just exfoliates new versions of itself. Novels seem to me to be the place where, if solutions were possible, what would they be like? What is the nature of hypothesis that would allow us to escape the endless wrangle with the self? The self can keep, just as we can go around this bush about novels endlessly and right. invent very beautiful arguments, pro and con. That's the thrilling thing. We're intelligent people and we like each other, so we could talk this way forever. But what if you wanted a form that allows you to stop the harangue? And that's what a story mm-hmm. seemed to be for me, beyond language mm-hmm. into perfection.
Interesting. I guess I'm definitely not interested in perfection. I think it's interesting that in a way that your problem, as you say, is or was life, and my problem is or was loneliness. The ending of my book, if I'm allowed to quote myself briefly,
yes.
the ending of my book, How Literature Saved My Life, puts the question pretty specifically. I say something like, I wanted literature to assuage human loneliness, but nothing can assuage human loneliness. Literature doesn't lie about this, which is precisely what makes literature so valuable. I guess it goes back to this idea of a conversation. I want to have a profound human conversation. And I guess that goes back to stuttering to a certain extent. I want the conversation to be two people being as smart as they possibly can be with each other. I find in, again, by way of contrast, in a lot of novels, it seems to me, the writer is sort of condescending to the reader, saying, let me hold your hand and tell you a story, and every 14 pages, I'll sneak in a nugget of wisdom. I want the nuggets of wisdom absolutely in every single sentence. I'm trying to argue not so much against the novel as for the essayistic gesture, the philosophical gesture, the meditative gesture. You know, in a way, I'm arguing for an ancient tradition going back to Heraclitus's Fragments and coming up all the way through, say, Maggie Nelson's Bluettes. It's that tradition I'm trying to embody in the work of literary collage, and I'm also trying to talk about many works that, to me, exemplify that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with David Shields about his book, How Literature Saved My Life, and really about his ideas about writing. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Shields about his new book, How Literature Saved My Life, the observations of a prolific writer and avid reader as he explores literature's conundrum. It can help you live, but not really. Now,
that's a good line. Exactly. The literature is not going to save my life. It's not going to save yours.
Now, you say you want the two people to be as smart as possible. But what about passionate? What about vulnerable? What about endangered? Because we are.
Definitely. I mean, I'm not interested in smartness for smartness's sake, a kind of tap dancing on the page in which I brandish to you my learning. That bores me greatly. When I say smart, I heavily imply ideas of vulnerability and nakedness. I mean, nakedness, as my students know and as my friends know, is really my highest term of praise. The other thing that matters to me hugely that I often find absent from the imperial stance of the novel is complicity. I love sort of an active human flawedness on the page. You know, that is what I really care about.
Then why on the page? Because what you're talking about, I try on a weekly basis to cause to happen here. A difficult, vulnerable, human and lost, flailing conversation by people who can flail articulately. So where does the writing come in? And the other thing that I would assume that you wouldn't like, the tradition of permanence behind most literature, the idea that it's eternal like the sonnets.
Well, I think it's a misnomer to think that I'm interested in a kind of sometimes people talk about my work, they seem to think that I'm arguing for a kind of Tumblr page or a Twitter account or a kind of glorified email. We live in this electronic post-digital age, and we have to figure out a way to write now in a way that has the compression, the concision, and the velocity of contemporary culture. And I find that in an awful lot of works of either redemptive memoir or conventional novel, it's as if we are still writing in the mid-19th century, which with a glacial plot, a foregrounding of setting, a Freudian notion of character, a godlike belief in life coming together with a certain kind of order and meaning. So I'm terribly interested in work that might have a surface chaos to it. But as I like to say, Michael, you know, collage is not a refuge for the compositionally disabled. You know, people sometimes read my work casually and think it's a kind of a writer's diary, but the works I've written are terribly carefully organized. You may or may not like them, but they are meant to be organized to within an inch of their lives.
I think that we share the love of J.D. Salinger and that it's a kind of undiminished love. And I have always felt that what I found in Salinger was a book that spoke directly to me, like a friend talking to me. And it's there in Catcher in the Rye and gets there more elaborately in the letter that the child writes back from summer camp telling about the books he's read.
Hapworth, 16th, 1924.
That's it. And then Seymour, an introduction where he's both talking to you and talking to himself and talking to everything at large. That book that talks to you, it's kind of there in literary books that become popular, like Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, sometimes, on again, off again. But it's,
right.
I think it's what David Foster Wallace very literally uses in Infinite Jest. The person talking to you, I'm in here, you'll have to find me, he tells us in the first paragraph. And you spend the first 200 pages of the book wondering who's talking to you who's been hurt so badly. Let's talk about the books that last regardless of their form, and maybe that Salinger blundered onto something, because certainly loneliness was something he loved rather than tried to avoid.
I think you're onto something, Michael. I think it is the bridge that you and I crossed together, and there's actually, it's far less distance between our passions than might at first appear.
I think we're the same person.
Yeah, exactly. That we are, I think I'm essentially interested, as perhaps you are, in human consciousness. That is what I find riveting, whether it's Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, Melville's Moby Dick, Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, J.M. Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello, Camus' The Fall. I love all of these novels greatly. And then I love a lot of essayistic gestures of, you know, everyone from, you know, Blaise Pascal's Pensées to E.M. Chiron's essays to contemporary writers of nonfiction. So I think the main thing I'm interested in as a reader and as a writer is access to another human consciousness. And for instance, Wallace to me is a wonderful example. I find Wallace more exciting by far in the essays than in the fiction. I don't know if you agree with that. Apparently not. But I find there's too much machinery going on in the novels.
Yeah, I love the machinery. And I'll tell you why. And I think it's latent in what you just said. We're both interested in consciousness trying to shut itself off, and it doesn't have the equipment to. How do you end? That's what Beckett is. That's what these récits, these monologues, are trying to do, to come to a conclusion, and it's something we don't have the capacity for. The brain doesn't know how to shut itself down. When it does, it starts to dream. To be outside all of that communication seems to me to be the great attempt of the greatest novelists, and it involves the imagining, the designing of a lot of very odd machinery, very strange strategies for self-abortion.
See, I'm not interested in consciousness shutting down. I'm interested in consciousness being thrilling. I'm not interested in obliteration. I'm interested in rapture.
Well, they say things burn most brightly before they go out.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder if I wonder how to take this other than that I'm terribly, I mean, I like what you say about certain writers and the thrill of their consciousness. And, you know, everyone has different writers they love. I'm just saying the writers I love dwell in their inmost consciousness to the greatest degree. I think the point I'm trying to get to is that every form has its built-in weaknesses. And the risk I take with the kind of work I do is that it's merely self, self, self. But if I'm able to get through the self, as I believe I do, I can have an incredibly intimate and loneliness-assuaging conversation with the reader, and that is worth a considerable risk, I think. Whereas I think, say, the novel, for instance, at its least interesting is a mere carnival barking, a kind of mere entertainment. Movies at their least interesting are mere sensation. Poetry at its least interesting is merely formal. Every form has its built-in weaknesses, and I certainly grant that if my work fails, it looks trapped in self. If it succeeds, it uses self to get at bottomless human concerns, and that's a risk that I and fellow travelers are more than willing to take.
One of the pleasures of talking to David, aside from an extraordinary level of identification that I have with him, is that when he talks about books, he says, books I love, so do I, and many people are embarrassed to. Ultimately, what I feel at the bottom of this kind of conversation is love. And that, I think, is what makes it worth the candle.
Nicely said, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've been talking with David Shields, author most recently of How Literature Saved My Life, published by Knopf. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from How Literature Saved My Life at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Rachel Kushner is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.